From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in 2002 in Massachusetts, where a doctor and activist was running for governor. Jill Stein had become known for her work in environmental activism. She was a prominent protester of the so-called Filthy Five coal plants in Massachusetts. She served on the board of the local chapter of Physicians for Social Responsibility. She was piling up service awards and recognitions. Jill Stein would not win that election. The winner was Mitt Romney. But Stein saw things that she later said changed how she viewed not only politics, but the Democratic Party. Stein had been turned off by the Democrats' actions on a number of issues, and in 2002, she was running as a Green Rainbow candidate. Almost immediately, she heard claims that she would just be taking votes away from the Democrat in the race. There was a solution, she said, and her party had worked with Democrats in the legislature to file a bill that would allow for ranked choice voting. Let people rank their preferences, Stein argued. And then you don't have to worry about who is taking away votes from whom. In 2016, she told the LA Times that Democrats didn't want a better voting system. They wanted to preserve their power. She told the Times, quote, "Why not liberate voters to actually vote your values? Democracy needs a moral compass. It's not a matter of just what we don't like and who we are most afraid of. We need an affirmative agenda if we're going to move forward as a democracy. Yet we have a voting system that forbids us from actually bringing our values into our vote, which is, in my view, quite a disaster. The reason they won't allow that is clear, because they rely on fear to intimidate people into voting Democratic. They don't want a candidate that actually can stand up for true Democratic Party values. That's very intimidating to the Democratic Party," end quote. Jill Stein was the Green Party candidate for president in 2012 and 2016. She received just under 1.5 million votes nationwide in 2016, around 1%. This year, it was initially reported that she would support Cornel West's presidential campaign, but when West dropped his Green Party bid, Jill Stein jumped back in. She has said there is no effective difference between Republicans and Democrats, and she wants to provide a different choice and a different agenda. Her campaign page cites her top priorities as an anti-war agenda, a Green New Deal, universal health care, ending the war in Gaza, among other issues. Dr. Jill Stein is in Rochester today, but first she's our guest for the hour here on Connections. Thank you for being here.
It's an honor. Thank you so much, Evan.
We were talking before the program began about why specifically you are in New York State in Rochester today, and the answer goes back a number of years to a time when the political power brokers were changing the rules on how you get on the ballot at all. Can you explain for listeners?
Yeah. I mean, there's a whole system across the country of ballot access laws. And these were basically passed in the early 1900s in order to push back against third parties. At the time, socialist parties were holding the offices of mayor, of state legislatures, of Congress, of governors, senators, et cetera, and having an enormous impact on everything from public libraries to public schools to labor laws to child labor, the 40-hour week, you name it. A lot was coming from that labor movement. And the pushback was about silencing it. It was about silencing working people. It was about silencing those who, you know, have enormous needs and are really the engine of our economy and of this society. And, you know, so fast forward to today, the Greens are challengers to a system which is not serving the American people. The American people are clamoring for other options. We know that in poll after poll. An annual Gallup poll is off the charts, showing about 63% want another choice and another option, at least one. And ballot access is how the ruling parties basically preserve their stranglehold on power. It's about silencing the opponent that they are afraid of. So Andrew Cuomo, a few years back, basically inserted a poison pill into the budget and ratcheted up extremely difficult ballot requirements at the outset. And instead of something like 15,000 valid signatures that had to be collected in about 12 weeks, something on that order, he ratcheted it up. The number went from 15,000 to 45,000 valid signatures, which means about twice that number has to be collected. And the time frame to do that was squeezed down to 6 weeks, making it almost impossible, making the state of New York the most difficult for challengers to a status quo which is not serving everyday Americans and which people are really chomping at the bit to overcome. So this isn't just about excluding third parties. This is fundamentally about excluding Americans from having the choices they are desperate to have.
to be clear again, you're saying that New York State has perhaps the most restrictive ballot requirements for third-party candidates or for non-Republicans and Democrats. Is that fair?
That's right. Yes. I mean, there are huge requirements also in California and Texas, to be fair. However, the Greens happen to have, we have ballot status in those states. So that's not an active issue for us. But yeah, for all comers, those states are very difficult as well. They require hundreds of thousands of signatures. But, you know, that puts New York basically up near the top because the time frame is so short.
What's the deadline for those signatures?
The starting date, I can tell you, is April 16th. So the ending date is the end of May. And I would encourage anyone who wants to have more than the zombie candidates that are being rammed down your throats, you know, very much against the will of the American people. If you want more choices, be sure you sign that petition, or even better, go to jillstein2024.com and become one of the petition carriers. It's easy to do. We train you up.
It looks to me like you are the de facto Green Party candidate. Is there any reason to think that you wouldn't be the Green Party candidate for president this year?
Well, you know, just that you never say never, but we do have at this point 90% of the delegates that are being appropriated in the various state contests. They haven't yet come to the majority, at which point we would be, you know, our campaign would be the presumptive nominee. So maybe that's a couple weeks off before we can actually say that.
And I take the point that you want people voting for something, not just voting out of fear or voting against something. And I wanted to ask you, you know, you're critical in many ways of the United States and policy systems. You're critical of many governments. Is there a government around the world right now that you point to and say, look at how they're doing it? That's what I want to do here. Is there one?
I hear really good things about Iceland. You know, Iceland has enormous democratic participation, small d democratic. People are very invested in their democracy. Labor is at, you know, among the highest. The representation of labor in unions runs really high. Economic disparities are very low. They have a generally a just and sustainable set of laws, and people are pretty happy there.
Okay, fair enough. And I want to give you some space to discuss the agenda that you believe is within reach and could be accomplished if you're elected, if Greens gain more power. So if you want to kind of discuss your priorities, and especially in a 2024 campaign, they may be very similar to 2016, they may not. But I want to give you some space to tell listeners about what you would like to do.
So let's start with healthcare as a human right for everyone. Everyone in, no one out. Right now is about 87 million Americans who either have no insurance or they're underinsured and they can't basically meet their needs. There's a system, you know, which would expand Medicare and fill in some of the holes where privatization has eaten away at Medicare. And this system could be expanded so that everyone is covered from cradle to grave, actually from the moment of conception to the grave. Everyone is covered. So when you get sick, you know, your first worry is not, uh-oh, how do I pay for it? But rather, how do I get better? And how do I get the care that I need? That is automatic. And things that are left out of healthcare now, even at the enormous cost that the American people are paying. And overall, you know, it's about 17%, I think, now of GDP. It's over $4 trillion a year that we are pouring into this system. It's not a healthcare system. It's a sick care system. It leaves out lots of people and lots of stuff, like your mental health care, like your chronic care, your eyeglasses, your dental care, and so on. There are huge holes in this, and it's, you know, it leaves 100 million Americans in medical debt, and that's especially people who already have health insurance. So it's an inadequate system, but here's the deal. It saves us money. It doesn't cost us, because right now one out of every three dollars spent on healthcare goes to paper pushing, red tape, and bureaucracy. It doesn't actually serve your health. Yet we are spending over twice as much as the next biggest country, the biggest spender among other developed nations. So we can do this much better. The American people want this. This is motherhood and apple pie. The only ones who don't want it are big pharma, the health insurance industry, you know, the usual suspects, and our politicians in both parties who are regularly being paid off by those industries and who are essentially bribed by our system of legalized bribery, that is through campaign contributions and lobbyists. That's why we don't have it. If we get elected, we will get that. You can be sure, because the American people want it. Another major priority for us is let's get rid of student debt. We bailed out the crooks who crashed the economy on Wall Street in 2008. It took about a week to come up with $1 trillion against the will and wishes of the American people. We can bail out the victims of this crashed economy, which doesn't allow students who did what they were told and now they can't pay back their debt. Why should you have to go into lifelong debt servitude in order to acquire the skills that you need to survive in this economy? Further, we can make public higher education free, a promise that Joe Biden made and did not keep. And now he's saying, oh, I'll do better next time. I'll create a free community college and so on. You know, we should have this. We know every dollar spent on higher education is returned to the economy 7 times greater. We know that through the GI Bill and our past experience. So this also is a no-brainer that pays for itself. It would unleash incredible economic development throughout our economy and enable young people to actually participate in a creative way and to take risks and to establish small businesses and co-ops and so on. So that is a win-win. We call for a Green New Deal, which is essentially like the New Deal that got us out of the Great Depression, but this would also fix the climate crisis and push back against the accelerating climate crisis at the same time. It would create millions of jobs at the same time that it protects Mother Earth, the climate, our ecosystems, et cetera. And let me mention also, we would have a foreign policy based on international law, human rights, and diplomacy rather than on the exercise of brute force. This is not only endangering the world, including the American people. We have at least 3 fronts right now where nuclear war actually could take place, where we could have a nuclear confrontation. You know, and we have a horrific track record. We've been losing war after war. You know, you can go all the way back to Vietnam, but in particular more recently, you know, from Iraq to Afghanistan to Libya and Syria and so on. We've been spending trillions after trillions. This costs the American people. Not only does it endanger the world and make a, you know, make the U.S. really kind of the global bully who is not appreciated and, you know, just throws our reputation into the mud. But this also, it costs us, well, it's about half of the congressional budget. And if you look at the household, the average household, what are you paying? We should have a war tax so that we understand how many of our tax dollars are being consumed for these endless and extremely devastating and catastrophic wars. But that's costing this year alone, and this is according to the economist Jeffrey Sachs, who's head of the Department of Sustainable Development at Columbia University. And the numbers that he crunches come up with about $12,000 per household this year alone that we are paying for these endless and catastrophic wars. And going back to the first, you know, post 9/11 wars, those cost us altogether it's about $50,000 per household. So, you know, this is a disaster that falls on the shoulders of the American people. We can do a much better job, better for, you know, world security and stability, our place among nations. We need to be a team player rather than the bully in the schoolyard. So those are some of the key policies. There are a variety as well, but those are kind of the main ones that affect most Americans.
Talking to Jill Stein, the Green Party candidate for president in 2012, 2016, very likely 2024. JillStein2024.com is the website. And, you know, I understand that you get frustrated by the claim that, you know, your candidacy would just take votes away from one candidate or another. Typically, the concern is that it would take votes away from the Democrat in the race. And I know you've heard that, as I mentioned at the outset, all the way going back to 2002 when you ran for governor of Massachusetts. And I know that you feel strongly about ranked choice voting, which we see in some small congressional district pockets, we see in some municipalities. I think there's growing support of it when people understand it. But we don't have it. We're not at the national level. We're not going to probably have. We're not going to have it this year. So I want to ask you just a functional question. You know, Quinnipiac is polling the swing states, and they recently polled, for example, North Carolina. When it's just Trump and Biden, Trump leads by 1.5 percentage points. It's essentially a tied race. When they bring in RFK and yourself, Trump's lead goes from 1.5 to 3 points. And the data indicates if a state is very close, like Michigan was in 2016, your candidacy could help someone like Donald Trump. Do you dispute that?
Absolutely. You know, you have to falsify the numbers, basically. You have to cherry pick the numbers.
I don't think I was cherry picking.
No, I don't. I'm not implying you, but this is the common interpretation. You know, there are these people will say, oh, you earned. So there are two different arguments here. So the one you're doing is you're citing polls. And the problem there is that polls are not citing the people who are eligible to vote and who don't vote. So it's like the base of the vote changes depending on who's in it. And what we know, I think the overwhelming issue here is that voters are clamoring for more. There are a lot of people who aren't going to vote. Look at the least recent New York State primary. The turnout was down over 80% over the turnout for the Democratic primary in 2020. So a lot of, you know, this is like astounding. The floor has basically fallen through underneath the Democratic Party. People do not want Joe Biden to run as their candidate, and they're not, and the Democratic Party refuses to allow any other choice right there, which speaks volumes in and of itself. But there is a huge bucket, bigger than ever now, I think, of people who don't vote, who won't vote, who are protesting by not voting. And that is huge. In 2016, that was 100 million people. That's where my voters came from. That's where Green voters came from. You can just by talking to people on the street, and you can also look at exit polls about who people voted for and who they would have, depending on, et cetera. But it's very clear voters who vote Green are not stolen. The very concept that votes are being stolen, I think, it's political repression, and it's also propaganda intended to smear and fear campaign both the choices that people are clamoring for and the voters. And it's an effort to shame voters from standing up for what they want in an era where people are hurting so badly for disparities, for the three billionaires who have the equivalent wealth of the lower half of the population altogether. You know, people really want to say something in this election, and they need other choices in order to say that. Whether that candidate, like myself, whether we win the White House or we simply win the day by saying, hey, we protest, this is not who we are. So, you know, I think the whole conversation, it's extremely anti-democratic to suggest that a certain candidate or a certain set of parties owns your vote. They have to earn your vote. They don't own it.
I think I take that point. And part of why I asked in this context is this. On this program, we interview candidates who are on the ballot, and we don't spend a lot of time talking about polling. We believe that it's important to talk to anyone who can be on a ballot and let listeners and let the public decide. I don't care if your polling's at 1%. If you're going to be on the ballot, you're going to be on this program. That's how we feel. I also am just looking pragmatically through the lens of this coming election and through the last 4 to 8 years. And some of the colleagues that you have in the Green Party here in Rochester have said on this program, they don't see any effective difference between Democrats and Republicans generally, or even really between Trump and Biden. Similar to what you said in 2016, you said, quote, Hillary Clinton is not different enough from Donald Trump that she or the Democratic Party are going to save your job, save your life, or save the planet. We have two ways to commit suicide here, and I say no thank you to them both, end quote. And yet, here's why I'm asking. Donald Trump is now the only president we've ever had who refused a peaceful transfer of power. And I want to ask you again if you really see no difference between that and someone like Joe Biden.
So let me say, I do believe Donald Trump is a threat to democracy.
A unique threat.
He's the only
president who has refused a peaceful transfer of power, and you don't think that's a unique threat?
I do think there are many ways to destroy our elections. That is one of them. I think also buying our elections out, I think throwing opponents off the ballot is also a unique and very dangerous threat. These are all signs of authoritarianism, call it, neo-fascism. We are seeing that in huge amounts from both parties across the board to look at the way that money has been enabled to buy out our election system across the board. I think we are in deep trouble. I think the barriers to having other candidates run. One of our candidates looked at this, did a international comparison, and found that it's actually more difficult in New York than it is in Moscow and in Russia to get on the ballot and to be an opponent.
But those aren't real elections in Moscow and Russia.
Well, I think we have real problems with our elections here as well when it is controlled by who the biggest spender is. Absolutely.
You really think it's more authoritarian in New York State than in Russia?
I wouldn't say more authoritarian. I would say it's more difficult to get on the ballot. I think when you add these things up, it is devastating to our democracy. This is why we need ranked choice voting. Who is opposing ranked choice voting, for example?
People in power?
Yes, and especially the Democrats. In Washington, D.C., it's now there's a referendum campaign to put it on the ballot, and the Democrats are trying to get it thrown off. You know, if you look at, the threats to our civil liberties, our right to protest and to free speech, the Democrats are also leading the charge there, in the censorship.
Censorship in what example?
Julian Assange is sitting in jail. He should be a free man. He's exercising freedom of the press. Why doesn't Biden let him out? He should. He's now suddenly saying, well, maybe I will. It would be really great if he did. But look at, for example, Cop City, where merely the right to protest is now considered eco-terrorism, where the protesters, one of them was shot, apparently for sitting there with his hands up. And you have this really vicious persecution and prosecution of protesters who are facing RICO charges and potentially decades in jail. And this is being carried out now by Democrats in particular, not that they have a monopoly on it, but I don't think the Democrats here get off as the guys who are going to save democracy. This is about, it's a stepwise decline into, an authoritarian and fascistic state. And I think there is no greater trademark of fascism than genocide, and that has been led by Joe Biden, who's been enabling the genocide in Gaza. So I find the argument that Joe Biden is the lesser evil, I reject that. I totally reject that. I don't see the parties as the same. I see them both as deadly and lethal and, a curse that we need to overcome.
Okay. In various flavors, you and Greens have said that functionally in what you believe is a system controlled by money, that there is not much of a difference between the parties. But, the examples I could read all day here. Republicans support restricting or banning abortion. Democrats support abortion rights. I mean, surely you don't think that's the same.
Well, let me talk about that for a minute, because there's more than a soundbite, to this issue. The Democrats had the power to codify Roe for decades. They both had, supermajorities in the Congress. They could have modified the veto override requirement. There were many ways that Roe could have been codified so that it was no longer subject to being repealed. They had like 40, 60 years to do that and chose not to.
Didn't always have power to do so.
But they did often. Remember, both Joe Biden and Barack Obama came into office saying that was going to be their first priority. But what was Obama's first priority? It was bailing out the banks, actually. So, the Democrats love this issue. It's a great fundraiser, and they have steadfastly refused to solve this issue when they could have. And I would add to this, the extremist Republicans, where did they come from? Remember that the Pied Piper strategy of the DNC, the Democratic National Committee, and the Hillary Clinton campaign was all about elevating the most fringe and extremist Republican who they thought it would be easier to beat. So they helped put Trump in a position to actually win the Republican primary, and the rest is history. But the failure, the miserable failure of that strategy didn't stop them from continuing it. The 2022 midterms, in fact, Democrats spent somewhere around $50 million elevating their most extremist Republican opponent so that they would then win
the primary. That's a strategy.
And,
yeah.
Well, it's not only a strategy. It has real-world consequences because then they have inserted people who then go on. They may not win that election, but they go on to win other lower offices and, you know, and to really change the temper of the Republican Party. So, you know, and also remember that people— very much today, too, but especially at the start. They were voting for Trump, not because they were for him, but because they were against Biden, they were against Clinton, they were against the impact of Obama and Bill Clinton, you know, before him for offshoring our jobs, for bailing out the banks, for throwing out millions of homeowners who were victims of predatory lending, not giving them a hand when the economy crashed. People were extremely angry at the track record of the Democrats. So, you know, because the Democrats are servants of the neoliberal agenda of corporate America, because they serve that agenda and because they have held power, they have driven people over to the Republican side.
I want to understand the Roe thing, though, because right now it is literally Democrats across the country voting and fighting to preserve reproductive rights. And you are criticizing Democrats for something, things that have happened literally now decades ago. Is it your contention that are you saying the Democrats didn't actually care about this?
It's not what I say, it's what I do. It's not what I say, it's what I do. So they're perfectly capable
but
of changing
the
their tune.
But who's doing the fighting right now? That's what I'm asking. I mean, if you look at Republicans and Democrats,
a lot of people are fighting.
You can't possibly say they're the same on an issue like this.
Well, I think that the issue has to be absolutely watchdogs. And there are states in which they are polar opposites, but there are states in which they are not. So— And let me also say that, remember, there were Democratic Congress people who were voting against Roe and who were voting against reproductive rights. You know, what was his name? Cuellar in Texas. Manchin. There have been very conservative Democrats that were relied on by the DNC to prevent all sorts of progressive legislation. And who supported those conservative and regressive Democrats? They were supported tooth and nail by the DNC when they had progressive challengers who would have removed the obstacles. So the Democrats toe a very fine line. They want the appearance of fighting for reproductive rights, but when push comes to shove, they drop the ball. Like the same thing with Medicare for All and single-payer health care. They're all for it until they have the power to do it. And then suddenly it's their donors who count at the end of the day. And same thing on the climate. I mean, you can look at issue after issue on the climate. Joe Biden, who just said maybe a couple weeks ago that he was going to stop the LNG plants, the liquid natural gas plants, he was going to put a hold on them. Well, another one just got approved. And, you know, they're on there. These are the equivalent of 440 new coal plants.
But you think Republicans and Democrats are the same on climate?
I don't. Yeah, you know, so I don't use that language. I don't say they're the same. I say they're not different enough. They are different around the margins, but only the margins. The Democrats are not going to save us on the climate. I mean, look at when did our fossil fuel exports explode? That was under Obama. That was under all of the above. So they're very good at the PR spin, at the public relations campaigns. You know, and Obama was supposedly all about renewable energy. And same for Biden. If you look at the Inflation Reduction Act, it's actually a fossil fuels first act. First, few people know this. But in fact, the Inflation Reduction Act mandates the sale of 60 million acres worth of offshore leases and 2 million acres of leases on public land. So it is devastating. Every year that has to be done before any major renewable projects can be built. So it's all about prioritizing actually fossil fuel energy. It is devastating to the climate. Yet the mythology is out there that the Inflation Reduction Act is going to save us. Unfortunately, electric vehicles are not going to save us. We need a whole system, and that has to begin with phasing out fossil fuels. By enhancing fossil fuels, they are writing our epitaph. And this began, you know, Biden has opened up more land and water for offshore excavation and extraction, ruining ecosystems across the board and enhancing climate emissions. Biden has been all about that, even though one of his promises, you know, was, no more public lands open for extraction. You know, and look at what happened with the Nord Stream pipeline. You know, the All the indicators point to the U.S. either as the one who did it or gave permission for it to do it.
I think the narrative that probably comes from people who would describe themselves as center-left Democrats, which is kind of a squishy term that's maybe not all that helpful. But I think what they would say is they feel that Biden has been pushed enough to actually get to a point where he does believe in a transition to cleaner energy, but he doesn't believe that we can do it on the timeline that you
well,
do.
Well, and he also
and so
has, and
it, it he is has, a, it is a transition has, that has to happen over some
but,
years.
But this is the big misconception. Renewable energy isn't going to save the climate. It's good for people, but it doesn't help the climate crisis one iota. What helps the climate is only reducing fossil fuels. And the Democrats have been all about pleasing both parties. They're all about expanding fossil fuels. That is their track record. So they are not going to help the climate actually at all. And if you compare what's happened under Biden with these new 22 new liquid natural gas export facilities that were built in the wake of the worst environmental sabotage ever, which was the explosion, the sabotage of the Nord Stream pipeline, which does point right back to the Biden administration. If you look at that event alone, what has that led to? These 22 new LNG plants, which are, and this is kept off of the news discussion entirely, that is the equivalent of building 440 new coal plants, which knocks us back to 2005 levels of emission. It basically erases all climate progress. And I have not seen anything done by Trump or any other Republican that is as destructive to the climate as what Joe Biden is doing with those LNG plants. So the propaganda really has to be looked at. I mean, look at the weapons of mass destruction, right? That's how we got into these series of wars, one after the other in the Middle East, these wars fighting terror, so-called. You have to examine the propaganda. And it's not only the propaganda that's driving us into extremely dangerous and destructive wars that are impoverishing us, but it's also the propaganda that surrounds the policies here at home.
You're critical of Democratic propaganda. Why are you not concerned that Republicans are telling their own voters that climate change isn't even happening because of human beings? We're in 2024 now, and that rhetoric is very powerful
among
their tens of millions of voters.
And we contest that rhetoric all the time, and we do criticize both parties. We criticize the duopoly, the parties
of
war and Wall
Street. Those parties are saying very different things.
You know what? I'm not too worried about, to my mind, both the propaganda is dangerous, whether you're saying, oh, I'm going to fix it, but you're actually not, or if you're just saying, oh, it's not a problem. To my mind, saying it's a problem, but then sneaking in the destructive policies, that's an even, according to Malcolm X, that's the wolf in sheep's clothing, which is even more dangerous than the out front wolf. I do not subscribe to the view that there is a lesser evil and a greater evil. In my view, we have two greater evil parties, and our job is to get moving with the greater good.
I want to ask you about foreign policy, and you've brought up a couple of things here. And I want to start by, and I'll put a little bit of my own bias on the table here. I'm not really interested in the questions you've gotten about who you had dinner with in 2015. I don't even think that's fair. I don't even think it's really perfect.
And please know that that was investigated for 3 years by the Senate Intelligence Committee.
I know.
Who found absolutely zero. This is a libelous smear.
So
if I wasn't a candidate, I could sue for it.
Dr. Stein is alleged by some people to have been, having dinner with Vladimir Putin at a time when you said you barely even had an English translation of what was being said. You were there to speak about something. He was speaking about something different. I take that point. Here's what I do want to ask you about, because I want to actually look at what you're saying now about Ukraine. Here's what you have recently said about Russia's invasion, and which is, by all accounts, an attempt to eliminate Ukrainian identity. You said, quote, however murderous and illegal the Russian invasion is, and all wars are murderous, nearly all are illegal. Russia's invasion was a provoked response to the bigger, more murderous and illegal game plan of the U.S. empire, in which overextending and defeating Russia is only one small part of the picture. So, yes, Russia illegally invaded Ukraine, but did so with a gun to its head, or in this case, nuclear compatible missiles. End quote. What you say there is close to a word for word repetition of what Putin told Tucker Carlson.
And I think I said it long before Putin did.
They had to invade Ukraine. What possible logic says they have to invade Ukraine?
So let me just say that war was ginned up, and it was an inevitable consequence of the eastward expansion of NATO. This was a promise made to Gorbachev. It was clear. Well, and let's look. What did Russia want? What did Russia want in order to avert that war, neutrality from Ukraine. They were talking about eliminating Ukraine identity.
No, they didn't want. Never wanted neutrality from Ukraine. They want a puppet state with Ukraine.
No, they wanted neutrality. If you look at what was on paper, look at the. After the war started, so there were many opportunities to avert that war if the U.S. had simply agreed to Ukrainian neutrality, like Austria following the Second World War, having a neutral buffer country in the pathway to invading Russia. How many times has Russia been invaded? Many, many times in the Second World War. They lost some 27 million people. So they're touchy about the border. We're touchy about our border, too. What did we do when Russia put nuclear missiles in Cuba? We launched the nuclear weapons into the air. But our leaders had the good sense to sit down and negotiate. That is Khrushchev and Kennedy. And one of Kennedy's remarks was, we must not fear to negotiate. We must not negotiate out of fear, but we must not fear to negotiate. We could have done that. There were infinitely many. And you know, for Russia to be touchy about having nuclear missiles on its border is, you know, like we do that as well. So that's not something to be bent out of shape about.
But they had to invade Ukraine then?
Absolutely not. Had we agreed not to put nuclear missiles on their border, they did not have to agree. They did not have to invade Ukraine. That was obvious. And that war has been a disaster, but we have ginned it up. We were very implicated in the coup that overthrew the democratically elected head
Yanukovych.
Of Ukraine. He was democratically elected. He was corrupt, as all get out, as all Ukrainian leaders are, including the one who's in office right now. They are corrupt. We're not overthrowing Zelensky because he's corrupt. That was not our business
you
to overthrow
Zelensky and
every...
Yanukovych are the same in terms of corruption?
I'm not saying that they are the same.
They are not the
same. I'm saying... Like, since when is it our business to overthrow every corrupt? I mean, why?
I hear you.
You
there.
Can look at leaders around the country who we install who are corrupt, who we
and
fight
wars. We have a
bad
track record in many ways.
We absolutely do. We should not be in the business of starting a war that could have been averted. We not only were, you know, what was her name? Victoria Nuland was there passing out cookies, supporting the very violent overthrow. And there are many... other avenues of evidence about the fingerprints of the U.S. in that coup. That's widely recognized that there was a coup and the U.S. had a major hand in overthrowing that government. What then ensued was a war on the eastern Russian-speaking provinces in which some 14,000 people were killed. So that war did not begin with Russia's invasion. It had begun long before. That's not to justify the invasion. It was an invasion and it was illegal. On the other hand, we played a terrible role in ginning that up and in destroying the tentative peace agreement that was achieved under the auspices of Turkey within 2 months of that
war. In
2022? That's
you
right.
You really think Putin was going to stop the war in 2022?
Well, he had already agreed. Yes, he had already agreed. And you can look at, I mean, even the testimony of the Israeli prime minister. This war doesn't help Russia. This is not a good war for Russia either. And they have shown every evidence of wanting to end that war and being willing to make compromises and to have simple, achievable agreements. Barack Obama did not want this war. Why? He said Russia has valid interests in that region. We, the United States, do not. Unfortunately, we have a military policy in this country that goes by the name full spectrum dominance. And this was leaked to the New York Times back in the 1990s. This was Pentagon language about our policy of dominating all areas of the world in all spheres of potential conflict and of beating down any potential power that could rise to prominence. And with the emergence of a stronger Russian economy, after it was devastated, you know, following the breakup of the Soviet Union and the installing of Russian oligarchs and so on, eventually their economy began to recover. And the U.S., regrettably, you know, has been expanding east to prevent the emergence of, alliance between Russia and the and Western Europe.
All right. So let me just ask a few things in good faith here, because I really want to understand a couple of aspects of this. You've spent a lot of time today saying that we shouldn't listen to what Democrats say. You should look at what they do. Look at their record. If their rhetoric sounds good on the environment, if their rhetoric sounds good on Roe, what have they done?
Mm-hmm.
You are not applying that same standard to Vladimir Putin. You're saying he said he wanted to negotiate in 2022.
And yet every
action indicates a desire to eliminate the Ukrainian people, or at least their identity, and subjugate them.
It could be interpreted that way, but let me tell you.
He has, but look at his actual words. Now you actually can look at his words. You can look at what he said in his hour and a half with Tucker Carlson. You can look at what he wrote in the 6 months leading up to the invasion, and what he said 3 weeks ago. 3 weeks ago, he said, American weaponry is running out for Ukraine. Why would I negotiate? He is giving you all the evidence that you need. He's not interested in negotiation.
Well, unfortunately, at this stage of the game, you know, it's horrible, and it's much more difficult to sort out than it's been along the way. But I think, you know, if you talk to experts in this field, like John Mersheimer, Jeffrey Sachs, who were actually there,
those are cherry-picked experts who blame NATO and the U.S. for everything.
I find their arguments compelling.
There are many experts who disagree with them.
Well, I'm not sure they have the same credibility. Oh, look at Chris Hedges, who's been, you know, a witness to history. People who've actually been there watching this through. There was not a respectable foreign policy person for the first several decades who wasn't screaming, don't move NATO to the east. This is a betrayal of our promise. This is a betrayal of stability of Europe. So, you know, I think you could interpret if you want, and the State Department and the Department of Defense do interpret this in a way that's very supportive of the goals of U.S. empire. I mean, look at who's actually an empire here. Russia actually cannot afford to have an empire.
Well, sure, but Ukrainians want to join Europe. They want to join NATO. And why do you think
they are
no
split.
More?
They are split.
Why do you think you know more than the Ukrainians who are desperate for this help?
Well, I would challenge you back. Why do you know more than the Ukrainians?
I've got a Ukrainian who works in this building.
Well,
and
he represents all Ukrainians. Ukrainians are split. You know, there is no doubt about that. Ukrainians are split. And the agreement prior to the war, the Minsk agreement, which U.S. and Western Europe went back on, that basically allowed for federated provinces in the east. When after the coup in the Maidan, the bloody coup, there was basically a war on Russian speakers, and their language was outlawed. And there were, you know, the hammer came down on the eastern provinces, and that then, you know, exploded into the conflict where 14,000 people were being killed. So Ukraine is split. There has long been a civil war in Ukraine. We do not have a right to solve that in a way that puts Ukraine at war with its eastern neighbor. Ukraine has a right to a negotiated solution, absolutely, and there are lots of people in Ukraine who want that. We interfered with that negotiated solution both in advance of the war and then after the war, and now it's a much more difficult quagmire to dig our way out of. But it doesn't help to keep fighting this, because who's dying? You know, it's the Ukrainians who are dying. Their society is being destroyed.
And I know you're concerned that the longer this fighting goes on, the higher the chance of a nuclear confrontation. I hear that, and I appreciate the fact that you're willing to tangle on these issues. Part of my bias does come from talking to a lot of Ukrainians and looking at this, being a little baffled that your platform is pro-peace, but you're saying Russia had to invade, and they are bombing apartment buildings and schools and hospitals.
Oh, it's horrific.
But you defend it as something they had to do, and that's just so strange.
Well, I simply want to understand and, you know, give voice to the complexity. This was not an invasion that came out of nowhere, and I have condemned that invasion.
Sure, because Putin says he thinks that Gorbachev made a mistake. Putin is looking to get back to the spirit of the 60s, 70s, and 80s.
I'm not interested in being Putin's best friend or installing him forever. I just don't want to see the Ukrainian people being devastated here. You know, they've lost a generation of people. I mean, their economy is a shambles. They require, U.S. subsidies to pay their teachers and their government
Absolutely.
Workers. This is a government waiting to collapse. It's been utterly destroyed by this war.
So what can you
which
do?
Could have been avoided.
If you're elected president,
yes.
What is the plan that you have for, as you say, seeing a negotiated settlement? What do you do?
Well, we go back basically to the settlement that was already negotiated and then almost renegotiated, which is essentially the Minsk Accords.
But Putin says he doesn't want it.
Well, that's what's going to have to be negotiated. What happens to those eastern provinces? Is Russia going to hang on to them, or will they have some
In
neutral
the
status? Yes, exactly. And I think Russia was threatened in the way that we were threatened when Russia put its missiles into Cuba. So we need to understand that threat and, you know, and find a way forward. But it is not rocket science if we understand, as, you know, John Mearsheimer and other experts on this area of the world and its longstanding conflict, if we respect that Russia has a need for security. We're not just going to single-handedly overthrow Russia. Vladimir Putin, for all his bumps and warts, he's very popular and widely supported in Russia. We are not going to overthrow Vladimir Putin. We need to withdraw, you know, ourselves from the
NATO?
Position. Well, that's a whole other issue. But what I was going to say was we need to stop being, you know, the guy who decides the relations of the whole rest of the world.
But would you seek to take us out of NATO?
I think NATO deserves to belong to the Europeans, not to the U.S. I think NATO needs
its own. Yes.
I don't think this is good for America, and it's not good for America to dominate Europe either. This is, you know, the recent U.S. policies in Europe have been a disaster for Europe, including the blow up of the Nord Stream pipeline.
Let me shift to you've talked a lot about Gaza, and I know this is a big concern for you. So let me ask you a question about whether if your views have changed since 2016. In 2016, you were asked by the LA Times editorial board if you supported a two-state solution with Israel-Palestine. And you said, quote, "I feel like I'm not as informed as I need to be to really weigh in on that right now. I need to go there, and I haven't yet. Until I have done that, I hesitate to put my feet down," end quote. So are you at a place now where you feel like is a two-state solution, A, possible, and B, what you desire?
What I desire is a solution that ends apartheid Israel. Israel cannot exist as an apartheid state with occupation and ethnic cleansing and genocide that all that results in. I think that has to be put first, to tell you the truth, because it's only going to polarize the parties more to be trying to settle the one state versus two state. So at this point, I'm most interested in, number one, stopping the genocide, stopping the ethnic cleansing, ending the occupation, and ending the apartheid state. That is a beginning from which we can begin to negotiate then
Netanyahu government. For starters, is what you're saying.
Well, it's more than post-Netanyahu, because unfortunately, this is not just the policies of Netanyahu, that the ethnic cleansing and the buildup to the genocide has been going
Israel
on for 75 years.
So if Israel elects a different government, but they have the similar disposition, what becomes the plan?
Well, I think let's get to step one first, which is to end the genocide, which needs to be ended today. It needs to be ended, you know, 6 months ago, basically.
So no more funding, no more money.
That's right. It's basically no more funds, no more money, no more diplomatic cover. And it's basically intercepting the shipments as well. I would actually do, you know, the UN itself is calling for a boycott of weapons shipment. We should be a part of that boycott. We should be a part of sanctions. What Israel is doing right now, I think, far exceeds anything, you know, in the world today and previously in terms of its just absolutely all out, you know, brutality and devastation. Israel at the moment and the U.S. with it are really the pariah among nations. We've been isolating ourselves in conducting this horrific, blatant genocide. And I think all the tools of nonviolent intervention need to be brought to bear on this.
Do you think Palestinians in Gaza can be led to a better life by Hamas?
I think so. You know, Hamas is serving all kinds of functions right now, not only their military wing, but they have a big, you know, civilian structure right now. And they arose because the PLO was doing such a bad job of meeting their needs. And they're in a horrible position. You know, they are an isolated country. Or they're not even a country. They have no rights. They're being absolutely, you know, steamrolled by their extremely militaristic and fascistic neighbor. So they are in terrible shape. I think we need to address the drivers of a terrorist pushback on the part of Gaza and the Palestinians. We have to get at what the cause of Hamas is, because before Hamas, it was the PLO. If we get rid of Hamas, it's going to be something else. You know, I think people need to be held accountable for their human rights abuses, for their war crimes, and that applies not just to Hamas. That obviously applies to Israel, whose war crimes dwarf anything that Hamas has done by many, many, many orders of magnitude. All violations of the laws of war, all war criminals need to be held accountable. But more than that, we have to get back to what it is that is driving, this small, violent force on behalf Gazans against this murderous occupation and apartheid.
We're down to about 90 seconds. I might misremember some of the details, but I think you've spoken pretty poignantly about your own family and your own history and understanding what it means to feel someone with Jewish identity to feel threatened, to feel targeted for genocide. I asked about Hamas because their own language has described a desire to end Israel, a very anti-Semitic and deeply, you know, violent lust towards anti-Semitism. And I just want to try to understand in our last minute if you see a path here that allows for something that looks like peace, whether it's two states or not here, because it just feels very intractable to me right now.
Oh, I would say absolutely. I mean, if you talk to the religious Jews who lived in Palestine before the Zionists came in, it was a peaceful existence. Anti-Semitism was coming from Europe. It wasn't in the Middle East. And this was a creation, you know, people were extremely traumatized in coming. You know, the Zionists were very traumatized. And it is, you know, and then and then equally traumatized others. You know, and that's not to say that the murder of 6 million Jews is equivalent to, you know, what Israel has done. But they're both absolutely horrific. I grew up as a very religious Reform Jew. And in the wake of the Holocaust, my grandfather's name was Israel. My grandparents had fled pogroms. And for me growing up, it was all about how are we responsible for each other? How do we develop a community and ensure that genocide never happens again, not to anyone? And from what I have seen in talking to Palestinians, in talking to Israelis, in my view, there is nothing here that's rocket science about solving this. We can do that. Go to jillstein2024.com to find out more.
I'll put a link to the website for the candidate in our show notes today. Again, it's jillstein2024.com. And if you missed it earlier this hour, the Green Party presidential candidate, the very likely nominee this year, who has run in the past, needs to collect 90 to 100,000 signatures in New York State to get on the ballot because of some changes instituted under Governor Cuomo a number of years ago. That's partially why Jill Stein is in Rochester today, and you are generous with your time to be here. Thank you very much.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks so much, Evan.
That's Jill Stein. We've got more connections coming up in just a moment.